Welcome to Cognitive Science 200. This is a kind of continuation, actually, of the series that I started last year called Neuroenigmas. We really did have a good time, I think, last year in the seminar, because the idea was to get people who specialize in certain topics, but to tell us frankly and honestly what it is that we really don't yet understand about the field, and to kind of depict those areas where research needs to be done, the kinds of things that we would really like to know. And so that's really motivated the series of talks that we will have this time. So I'm going to start off today by talking about an issue that probably affects all of us, and that's the issue of free will. Now, before I do that, I want to introduce Roger Bingham and sort of explain what all of this is about. Very briefly, Roger, along with Terry Sinofsky, has started something truly wonderful, and that is the Science Network. And they have a number of projects for the Science Network, and they webcast lots and lots of wonderful material, including the material from the very recent two-day meeting called Beyond Belief, which had to do with the tensions between science and religion. And Roger has then a variety of projects, because he's very creative. And one of the projects he calls the Preservation of Endangered Speeches. And what he observed last year in attending the Neuroenigmas talks was that a number of faculty really kind of bared their souls in a way that they normally wouldn't, and that this would be a wonderful thing to have on tape and to capture. So we are beginning today to tape the first of this series, and it's slightly awkward for a number of reasons. One is I really like to be able to see you, and I can't really, especially, you know, it's like a bloody black hole over there. So I can't really see anybody there. And I also have this very unfortunate habit, which is that I move about. And so the guy who's with the lights will have a tendency to get anxious over there. So there may be a certain amount of anxiety racket, CRF racket over there. And the other thing is that I really do want the seminars to be interactive. I want you to ask lots of questions. I don't care whether you think they're stupid or not. I don't care whether you think they're off the wall or not. This is the sort of seminar where you really do get to ask those kinds of things that are, you know, nagging at you and bothering you, and that normally you might only ask in the context of a bar and one or two vodkas. So I really do want you to, I want to encourage you to be very open and comfortable and easy and interactive. And that's also a little bit hard when you've got the lights and the camera and so forth. But you'll get used to that. But Roger will ask, I think, that if you want to raise a question, and I do mean that you should interrupt me. Anyhow, thank you, Roger. And it is an experiment, and we'll just see how it goes. So I put this first slide up because I want to really convey a little bit about the background of the problem. And the background of the problem is that you can't kind of isolate the issue of free will from a whole lot of other issues in the way that you might, for example, isolate the notion of combustion from a whole lot of other issues and then try to investigate it. And that's because we care about free will for social reasons. It's because we are social animals that we have a particular take on the issue of responsibility, and it's really in the context of responsibility and assessing and judging responsibility with a view to changing behavior that we care very much about the notion of free will. Consequently, what we are going to focus on is something that's approximately in here, which means that there are issues from anthropology, from comparative biology, developmental psychology on the one hand. Social neuroscience has begun to study the nature of decision making at the single cell level, as well as planning, the nature of social attachment and how bonds are formed and what exactly are the circuits that mediate that sort of behavior, the nature of aggression and cooperation and trust and so on. So there's obviously there's a real synergy between these areas. But then, of course, there are the issues of legislation and the criminal justice system. And so we want to understand in the deepest way possible, informed by science, the conditions under which we ought to excuse someone from, for example, violent behavior. And if they have a tendency to violent behavior, but we need to excuse them, we still need to address the issue of social safety. And so it's very complicated, and these things intertwine with one another. Now, despite all those complications, I'm going to try to sort of wade in here and be as clear as I can. But there will be many things that you will know that I don't. And there will also be perspectives and take on these problems that you will have that I don't. And that's one of the reasons why I really want to encourage you to speak up and to let me know how you see things or what else you understand that perhaps I have missed. So, what is the story, shall we say, about free will? What exactly is the issue? What's going on? And I'm going to start from a fairly sort of simple place. I think probably I have to preface much of what I say with the phrase, to a first approximation. So just assume that in most of what I say, that phrase is there. That way I won't have to repeat it. But to a first approximation, we collectively, not just in the academy, but we and the folks in our culture, have certain kinds of background assumptions about free will. And we have a certain view about how it is that we make decisions and choices. It seems that apparently there is a sequence of events. I deliberate, a decision is made, and I act. And the word I, of course, is very important in this. It's that I consider the options. I choose, I intend, I act. Now, some folk psychological / philosophical ideas about this are that I create those choices. It is a kind of act of creation. And that I or my will operates independently of physical causes in the brain. That when I choose to have a drink of water, that it isn't that I am compelled to or that the causal flow of events in the brain brings that about. It's that it's created by me, this choice. We also sort of have the view that if it weren't like that, if there weren't this sort of causal vacuum within which I exercise my will, that I would be like unto a puppet, where I don't really have any choices, I could not do otherwise, I am being manipulated. I may do a dance, but of course that dance is all a function of the causal relations between the controller and me. Now, we kind of buy into that, but we also kind of don't. And I think especially those of you who work in the brain and behavioral sciences, you really are very uneasy about the whole folk psychological framework for thinking about these things. And so let's just remind ourselves about the kind of background materialist considerations that we bring to our science. For all we can tell now, and we know quite a lot, there is no brain-independent thing that thinks and feels, that makes decisions, that creates choices. There is just the physical brain. It's conceivable, but it seems empirically highly improbable that there is some non-physical spooky stuff in which the thinking and the feeling and the choosing and all that inheres. The brain is amazingly complex. Sometimes it is said that it's a mirror machine, but we know it's no mirror machine, that it is, as sometimes Dan Dennett puts it, wonder tissue. The complexity is so extraordinary that we really can't fathom how you can get out of mere neurons, this wonderful arrangement of things that we do. The mind, what we think of as thinking and feeling and deciding and choosing, is really a function of patterns of activity in the physical brain. Now, that's, of course, to say something very general, and what many people in neuroscience want to do is to understand what those networks precisely are like, what precisely are the mechanisms that allow us to do things like see in depth or make decisions. Additionally, although we are often sort of in a conventional sense inclined to think of ourselves as this I that stands aloof from or independent of the brain, the self is really a construct of the brain itself. We don't know exactly what kind of a construct, and we don't know how the brain does this amazing thing, which is within itself to make a distinction between this and that. Right? So it has a model of the external world, the world of nettles and fish and water and fire and all that, but it also has a model of the internal world. And somehow within the structure of the brain itself, that distinction is made. Self-representation is almost certainly multidimensional. It is probably more complex in primates than it is, for example, in turtles. But even fairly simple animals need to have a representation of their inner milieu, their temperature, their glucose levels, and so forth. They also need to have a representation of their body, where things are relative to other things. So we might, in a folk psychological frame of mind, think of ourselves as the puppeteer in there. But of course, that's kind of an illusion. So it's those sorts of things that I think motivate many students in the brain and behavioral sciences to say, look, there must be a different way that we need to think about. And part of what I want to do is explore those different ways and to think about the impact on the wider social world of what these changes mean. They didn't seem to me, actually, to be tremendously significant until, I guess it was perhaps last year, and it's part of the Neuroenigma. No, it was the year before when Rick Blue and I ran this series. And Herb York, who was the first chancellor of UCSD, gave a talk to CogSci 200. And because he had been involved both in the building of the bomb and in advising the president vis-a-vis dropping the bomb, and because he had been involved in negotiating disarmament treaties, he had a fascinating story to tell. And one of you said to him, so the issue of the bomb and its significance and what it meant to society to have the bomb and have it dropped, that was a huge issue for your time. What do you think is the issue for our time? And I thought he would say something within the political domain. And he said, I think the issue of free will and its impact, that is the scientific understanding of that and its impact on society, is the big issue. And quite honestly, I mean, he's not a philosopher, and I guess I should have thought that. But it really took me aback. And it provoked me to think about why he said that. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that in his characteristically deep way, he was absolutely right. Now, part of what I suggested, at least with regard to the folk psychological story, is that we tend to think of our decisions as created within a sort of causal vacuum. And so we need to ask the question, can we have a conception of voluntary choice where we recognize that causality operates? So I'm going to give you a little bit of history, and then I'm going to go into some detail on what contemporary psychology has taught us about these things. David Hume in the 18th century, I think, gave the classic response to Descartes, who really did think that unless you had uncaused choice, you were essentially a puppet. And Hume made the observation, simple, clear, as many of his observations were, that, in fact, of course, decisions must be caused by background, antecedent, desires, character traits, moods, temperaments. All of these things must be part of the causal background. But the kind of deeper point, in a way, that he made that really surprised people was that uncaused actions or uncaused choices would actually be, in a certain sense, random and kind of nuts. So suppose that, for example, all of a sudden, with no causal antecedents, I decide to sing Strawberry Fields. And you say, well, why did you do that? I mean, you don't have a good voice. You don't typically do that. Nobody wanted to hear it. I just decided. You'd be worried, right? You would be worried. And I think it's a point that many quantum physicists who think that the solution to the problem of free will is going to be found in quantum mechanics have totally failed to understand. We can talk more about that too, but it is, I think, worth pondering that the kind of free will worth wanting, as Dan Dennett would say, is not the free will where, in a causal vacuum, I suddenly decide, I think I'll take off my shoe and throw it at Roger, right? Or sing Strawberry Fields or what have you. Doesn't make sense. It must come out of ourselves, our character, our hormonal milieu, our homeostatic measurements, and so forth. All right. But then, of course, Hume had to ask himself the question, so if it's all caused, and of course we do believe the brain to be a causal machine, what is the difference between behavior that we want to think of as voluntary and for which we want to hold people responsible, and behavior that isn't? And although it's not a terribly illuminating answer, it does kick off a research program. And what he says is, they have to be different kinds of causes. And quite reasonably enough, then, if I can put his idea in more contemporary language, what we want to know is what's causally different in the brain between me when I feel that it's time to wash my hands because I just cleaned a chicken and an obsessive compulsive who must constantly wash her hands. There's got to be a difference. We want to know what that difference is. As part of sort of housekeeping here, I just kind of want to draw your attention to a couple of things. One is that if an event is unpredictable, and of course lots of what we do is not perfectly predictable, nothing follows about whether it was caused or not caused. Lots of unpredictable events are perfectly caused. Today's a windy day. I go up on the top of the building. I throw down a $5 bill. Its exact trajectory, millisecond by millisecond, is unpredictable because the wind is turbulent and blowing all over the place. Nobody would say, wow, you know, it's got free will. It's unpredictable, must be uncaused. I mean, you might have thought that if you were, you know, a very primitive sort of Stone Age person, but you certainly, well, even they wouldn't have thought. So that's one point. The way physicists use the expression undetermined usually does mean not caused. All right. So the suggestion, if we think that the brain is a causal machine, what we mean is that it goes from state to state as a result of antecedent conditions. Had the antecedent conditions been different, this event would have been different. Okay, does anybody want to sort of plunge in at this point? I'm still sort of laying out kind of background things. All right, so let's go back and look a little bit at the philosophical ideas. I create my choices via reason. My will operates independently of the physical causes in my brain and so forth. Now, first of all, there is, I think, the presumption that the important factors that go into decision-making are all in the conscious domain. And of course, as most of us know very well, that isn't true. That many factors that are critically important for a decision are in the non-conscious domain. So let's just talk about a few of those. The best known is the work that was done by Benjamin Libet. And just in case not everybody knows about that work, I'll tell you very briefly. He puts electrodes on the scalp and takes EEG recordings. I am a subject, and all I have to do is, when I feel the urge to press a button, I'm going to do it. Right? So I just kind of sit there. All right. Just when I feel the urge, what I'm going to do is notice on the clock, it's got a big sweep hand, where the sweep hand is. And at the end of the experiment, I say, you know, it was at 10 or wherever it happens to be. Okay. So I just do this. I feel pretty much in control. Things are going along very nicely. He analyzes the data at the end, averaging over many trials. And what he finds is that on average, about 300 milliseconds before I signal that I have the urge, or before I record my urge, and about 500 milliseconds before I move, the readiness potential begins to show itself, which is a sort of, nobody exactly knows what it is, quite frankly, but it's robustly there before you make a movement, and some people call it movement preparation, but in any case, there is activity in the frontal structures that begins long before. I mean, 300 milliseconds in brain time is long. Long before the intention forms and long before the action. And many people have tried to refute this, but the data are very, very robust. You can do a slight variation of it. Patrick Haggard has done this, where in addition to recording from getting the effect here, he looks at lateralized potentials, and they are also antecedent to the intention. And this is kind of suggested to some people that, well, maybe the intention is not the thing that constitutes, you know, it all coming together, I'm going to do it. Maybe it is really just your awareness that the decision has been made non-consciously. So decision-making may be quite a different thing. We also know, of course, by the work done by psychologists on subliminal perception, that you can affect people's choices and decisions by presenting subliminal stimuli. One that's very well known is that a person who has a tendency to want comfort food, if you give them a subliminal, like flash for a millisecond or 2 milliseconds, picture of something very nasty, they're likely to go get some comfort food. If you make it above threshold so they actually see it, they don't. But there are many, many experiments. Tony Marcel has done experiments, and who's the guy? Zients. Paul Zients has done other experiments showing the effect on conscious behavior of subliminal perception. The work by social psychologists, I think, is important here, too. Everybody probably has their favorite social psychology experiment, but the kind of classic one is where you have 10 identical pairs of pantyhose. They're put on a table in a supermarket, and women who are shopping are asked to, you know, come and have a look and choose a pair of pantyhose and then explain their choices. And they tend to pick pantyhose on the rightmost position, or at least there is a big position effect. And of course, when they explain their behavior, no one ever says, well, you know, there's a position effect, and I'm sort of, you know, I'm a normal human, so what do you expect? They always say, well, you know, it's a better color for me, or it's more sheer, or these have a better denier than the others, or whatever it happens to be. So there's a real worry there. It'll come back. I find speech amazing, because speech is greatly impaired if you try to make conscious intentions and decisions about what you're going to say next. Unless, of course, you're in a remarkable situation. For example, you know, you've just gone through a stop sign and you know what you're going to say to the cop, and so you're rehearsing and rehearsing, blah, 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 and then it doesn't usually come out right anyway. But yeah. but there you are, right? I'm talking, and I can't possibly, there isn't time for me to have conscious decisions. It just comes out. But it's voluntary in the sense that if I said something really dreadful, you would certainly hold me responsible for it. So one of the most common things that we do is not preceded by anything like decisions and choices. Another very common thing that we do all the time, unwittingly, non-consciously, very intelligently, is make eye movements. And you've all seen those wonderful Jarbusch diagrams that show, as a function of task, you will make a pretty regular and very intelligent scanning of the relevant scene. I never, or almost never, unless I'm in the optometrist's office, make a decision about where to look. Right? It just, you know, it doesn't. And then there's the question of whether, within the folk psychological framework, those links between I considering, I choosing, I intending, why do we think those are causal? I mean, does it ever happen to you, for example, and this goes also to the question of are the connections tight? Do you ever, I mean, here's what happens to me all the time, right? I'm lying in bed, and I make a decision to get up. I don't get up. It doesn't. I just don't. It doesn't particularly bother me, but I mean, phenomenologically, I'm aware of this. And then I start thinking about other things, and I think about making coffee, and then I find I'm up. It's not like there had to be this thing, this phenomenologically identifiable event. And even when there was that thing, it wasn't always followed by the action. And that makes me very suspicious that there may not be anything like those particular events. And even if they are there, they may not be related in those kinds of ways. So do we confabulate? Well, I've already given you an example of confabulating why you did something. But confabulation, of course, is very common. But I want to give you a wonderful example of confabulation where you provide an explanation, but we know the explanation can't be right in the context of choice. And this is work done by Lars Hall. So here's the way the experiment works. You're a young red-blooded male, and I'm going to present to you pairs of pictures of females. And then your job is simply to pick out the one that you find most attractive. Okay. So you find that quite an easy task, and you do it. And once you've made your choice, I put my hands over the pictures. And sometimes, because I'm a real Houdini, I manage to shift them, right? And then I show you what you chose, and I say, now, can you explain to me why you chose this person? It doesn't matter, and people do not notice that the shift changes, right? So you have this nice black-haired lady and this nice blonde lady. The guy chooses the black-haired lady. I mix them up, and then I present to him, I say, okay, here's what you chose. Why did you choose that, right? The blonde lady? And he says, well, because I'm sort of partial to blondes. Right? And it doesn't really matter which, you know, what I had. You make up a plausible explanation. Now, it's not because you're mendacious or whatever. That's just the way we do things. So that this has prompted some people to wonder whether, within the folk psychological domain, what we're calling intentions are really kind of ill-formed awarenesses of the unconscious decision. But given our culture, when we feel we need to explain, we know what an appropriate explanation would be, right? And we provide it. The confabulation results, of course, really came to the fore with the split brain patients. And even now, I am spellbound when Mike Gazzaniga talks about the following kind of thing. So there is Vicky. You flash to her right hemisphere a message, and the message says, get up and close the door. Vicky gets up, closes the door, and you ask her, now it's only her left hemisphere that can speak, you say, so why'd you close the door? She says, oh, it's breezy in here. Or she'll say, I wanted some privacy. She never ever says, I don't know, I just did. She never says, look, I'm a split brain patient. You probably flashed something to my right hemisphere. It's very interesting. I mean, we have this way of organizing what we think we are. Very, very interesting. All right. Dan Dennett has often said that, and this is something that, you know, at a phenomenological level, like if you just attend introspectively to what's going on, that often it's not like a decision is an event. It's like you're sort of waiting for the decision to bubble up, right? You think, well, what should I really do here? Well, go sleep on it, and you wake up, it's there. You know what to do. So the thought is, at this point, that it may be that we need to really kind of rethink the whole structure of what goes into decision-making and choice and so forth. And part of what I'm going to suggest a little bit later is that the notion of self-control might actually serve us better in this context than the notion of free will. Because free will seems to suggest, for example, that either you have it or you don't. Whereas we know self-control comes in degrees and can vary as a function of all kinds of things, including developmental stages, hormones, brain damage, and so on. And then I think it will be easier, too, if we have that kind of a framework, to begin to think about the neurobiology of self-control and how it is possible for something to have dysfunctional self-control. And we'll talk a bit about that in the context of frontal damaged patients. But more importantly, how is it that we can defer gratification? What's the circuitry for that? I know how folk psychology invites me to think of that, that I have a strong will and that sometimes my will is weak. But that can't be right. And one thought, and Guy Claxton has, as I think, a very interesting idea about this, is that part of what goes into developing self-control and learning to defer gratification is learning to predict what things are troublesome for you and then doing them slowly. right? So you've been punished for a certain event. You're tempted by it. If you do it slowly, it allows time for the brain to construct other scenarios, to construct mental images of the bad thing that will happen, and that allows different circuits to take over and so forth. And so it's a way, this is very preliminary, obviously, but I think it is a kind of invitation to think about a research strategy that looks at the will in quite different ways. So now I want to do, I kind of want to switch gears a little bit, because at the beginning I said that the notion of responsibility is part of what makes discussions about choice so important. I mean, it's not just that we want to understand ourselves, and that's certainly part of it, but we also live together. And so I want to start with a very common idea, which once you've kind of stripped away all of the sophisticated verbiage and just put it down in its horrible nakedness, it's obviously not a good argument. But people do, sorry.
I have a question about the confabulation thing.
Yes.
So before that we talked about an internal sense of self and that being distinct from the external world. So having to confabulate, is that kind of comes by default because we're, you know, having an internal, that we have a sense of ourselves. And suppose we were supposed to say things that were in general or the factual belief, and that would actually diminish the boundaries between self and non-self.
What an interesting question. The question is whether or not confabulation and the way that we proceed to explain our behavior in this framework we have, if that were actually replaced by something more accurate, might that not in fact diminish this separation between this thing and that thing, between self and non-self? And it is an extremely interesting question, and I don't know how to answer it. So I'll just say one little thing, and that is, it is very interesting, of course, to think about those sorts of cases where there is a breakdown between self and non-self. And the classic case are in the depersonalizations. When people take ketamine, for example, normal people will experience a kind, I've not done it, so I can only report what people say, but it's a kind of fascinating thing that it's as though the boundaries no longer exist. And of course, notoriously, this is also true in schizophrenia. So, but it's a very interesting idea that perhaps part of what we need to keep self from non-self separate is that we have one story about this thing and a quite different story about the other thing. Wonderful idea. So in thinking about the idea of free will, and perhaps with a view to preserving the folk psychological idea of a creative will, someone might argue as follows, that we can retain the notion of holding someone morally responsible only if you have this causal vacuum type free will, contra-causal free will. We do, in fact, hold people morally responsible, so there must be such a thing as contra-causal free will. Now, it's obviously a bad argument. It's a fallacious argument, for one thing. But I'm wondering about that first premise. I think we hold people morally responsible even though they are causal machines. So where does this idea of moral responsibility come from, and what's it all about, and what gives it legs? And I want to approach that in a way as a scientist would, as opposed to thinking about it independently of what we already know about our genetic nature and our social nature. I think the most plausible explanation is that attributing moral responsibility and sanctioning for unacceptable behavior arises from the social need for civil behavior. If we're going to live together, we get tremendous benefits. We can engage in group defense, we can share food, and then, of course, in a technologically advanced society, I don't have to pull my own teeth or amputate my own leg or make my own shoes or fly my own airplane and so forth. Animals who live in groups, this is true of primates, wolves, and birds, social birds, they live in the group, they thrive and flourish and live much longer than if they don't. So from a biological point of view, and I'll get back to this a little bit later, the idea of moral responsibility seems to be part of what we exact as a cost for you to get the benefits of being in the society. And so we need to socialize children, we need to protect ourselves from those who would otherwise be violent, we need to be able to deter people. And this is something on which I think Richard Dawkins and I probably disagree, but I think that revenge is probably a kind of ineliminable urge that humans have. It may be morally unacceptable, I have no way of evaluating that. But it's clearly a very important thing to have institutions, in our case the criminal justice system, for revenge. Because if people take the law into their own hands, then there's retaliation and more retaliation. It goes back and forth. And we don't want to talk about Iraq right now. So how do we assign responsibility? And again, if I think about this biologically, and I think Aristotle really did, the point is that you want to hold people responsible if that gives you social value. So there's no point in punishing somebody if they did a bad thing while sleepwalking, or there's no point in punishing somebody if they were voluntarily intoxicated, and so forth. Or if it was simply a reflex, you don't punish them. Otherwise, and his view was that we take responsibility as the default and we will consider excuses as they come up. And the excuses that I'm kind of interested in for this purpose is what it is to not be in control, or what is it to have diminished control or compromised control. So I want to talk a little bit about that now. There are many studies of patients with frontal damage, orbital frontal damage, as well as ventromedial frontal damage. And I think the work of the Damasios is quite well known, but as the basic story is that such patients are often quite have normal IQs, normal memory, or otherwise unexceptional, but they are very poor at making practical decisions. And it turns out that there is a kind of disconnect between subcortical structures that regulate emotions, such as the amygdala and the septum, and these prefrontal structures. This particular one I found very interesting because this is a scan of an adult who suffered the prefrontal damage as a child. And we've now seen a number of cases like this. And the problem with early frontal prefrontal damage is that you not only see this difficulty of making good practical decisions, but they have enormous difficulty learning basic social distinctions between what's a prank and what's violent and so forth. So there's some important story to be told there. In this slide, this I think is, this is the what was used in the article in The New Scientist that I put on the website for you to read. It was this was the hook. This was a man in Virginia who had lived a very normal life. He was married for the second time. And his wife had a young daughter, about 8 years old, and after they had been married for some time, he molested the daughter. And the daughter reported this to the mother, whereupon the police were called. They discovered on his computer that he had a rather impressive collection of child pornography, and needless to say, everyone was very upset, and he was taken away and put into a 12-step program in hopes of some improvement. He got worse and worse as he was in the program, in the sense that he groped the nurses and he would say all kinds of lewd things, and there seemed to be a real lack of self-restraint and impulse control. So he was about to be sent to prison, since he was failing in the 12-step program, when he began to complain of very severe headaches and he showed a certain amount of vertigo. When he was scanned, this was what turned up. It's a benign tumor, and as you can see, the tumor has invaded huge areas of the frontal structures, and in presumably putting pressure also on regions that regulate sexual behavior, such as the septum and the hypothalamus. Once the tumor was removed, he was back to normal. And he moved back in with his wife, and things went on very well. It turned out, however, that a small bit of tissue remained and began to regrow, and he began again to feel the same urges and impulses, and he went back for surgery, and once again, those impulses died down. Now, I find this case really interesting because we recognize the frank abnormality of this, and then one wants to think about sort of the growing awareness of sexuality in pubescent and prepubescent humans. I mean, it's not like it's a choice to have sexual fantasies in math class, exactly. And it's not that it, do you know what I mean? So is there really that huge a difference between oneself and this person, except that he has a tumor? I mean, is it that his behavior is somehow caused and mine isn't? No, that's not going to work. And so it does, I think, really in a very dramatic way, especially, I think, because of the power of hormones and other aspects of the endocrine system. It really does raise it in a very important way, these kinds of issues. Yeah?
Roger has a question.
Oh, Roger has a question,
I was going to ask you, I don't remember reading, was there a report of what he said he was feeling and why he thought he was doing it during the first set of studies?
No, actually there wasn't.
That would be really interesting.
It would be really interesting, and I've wondered whether it might be nice to go and interview him and so forth, but of course at this point he's probably not going to remember, or at least he'll reconstruct and say all kinds of things, so it probably won't be very meaningful. But it would really be very, very interesting. Yeah. Anything else on this one? Okay. So I was suggesting earlier, sort of preparing you in a way for this slide, that it might be useful to kind of put on the shelf for the moment this somewhat problematic idea of a free choice versus a not free choice, and talk about being in control versus not in control, while recognizing, of course, that there are going to be degrees. And to approach this by identifying obvious cases where people really lack control. And so far, we've looked at people with prefrontal lesions. The MAOA mutants I'll come back to, but people with obsessive compulsive disorder. I mean, clearly there is something about executive function in that instance, as also in Tourette's, that is just very different. I don't know whether any of you have seen this amazing tape that was done by the CBC of the surgeon, Mort Doran, who is a Tourette-er. He's the man that Oliver Sacks wrote about in the New Yorker many years ago. And he, of course, has thought a great deal about his disease. And so in any case, they show him, you know, at home, and he's ticking and ticking, and he all often, you know, just comes out with things like, idiot, idiot. And then he goes back, and we have a conversation, stupid, stupid, stupid. And then we continue. And it's really quite surprising, actually, to see this. But it's also interesting how quickly you get used to it.
Just like a faculty meeting?
Yeah, well, yes, yes. Not unlike a faculty meeting. And he, you know, is constantly adjusting his glasses and, you know, doing this and so forth. And so you think, how does this work in the hospital? That's the big question. Especially, how does this work if he's a surgeon? And so they ask him, well, you know, do you have to tick? And he explains, and this was evidently true as a child, too, that you can inhibit it for a while. And he'd say that, you know, when he was at school, he would try very, very effortful to inhibit it. But that as soon as he got home, he'd run out into the back field and just let fly. It was as though, you know, it had stored up almost. In any case, so you would see him at the hospital, and he'd be walking down the hall, you know, touching the walls and doing tick, tick. And nobody seemed to pay very much attention. Then they showed him coming into the surgery to do an appendectomy, and you think, I don't want to watch this. You're going to nothing like that. All of a sudden, it's like he's calm. And nothing happens. There's no ticking. He talks to the nurses. He does the surgery. He sews up. He's finished. He takes off his gown, and then he just ticks like crazy. He goes through all of this. I mean, it's fascinating. And you think, oh, well, if I was constantly, you know, walking down the street saying, idiot, 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 I would sure, you know, suppress that. Well, but it isn't like that, right? There, you don't. So we want to know what that is all about. I want to say a little bit about the MAOA mutants because I think they're very important as we think about the possibility that we may want to review some aspects of the criminal justice system. And, and this slide is not going to be new to any of you, but in this slide, I really just want to remind you about the circuitry between structures important for reward, like the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area that projects to the nucleus accumbens, and also areas such as the amygdala, which are important for regulating a variety of emotions, but in particular, fear and inhibition of action. And there, of course, is the septum and the hypothalamus. And so there's this really, really dense connectivity between these areas. And what would be important, and of course some researchers are working on this, would be to understand it in much greater detail. Now, in thinking about, I'll come back to the MAOA mutants. I'll tell you about them right now. And I'm just going to give you the very fast story. I mean, a lot of this, as you can tell, I'm going skating over very fast. So a number of years ago, Terry Moffat and her group in New Zealand asked a very interesting question. And the question was that there seems to be in the male population a certain percentage of male children that tend to be that have, as we might say now, conduct disorders, are sort of aggressive towards other children, get into fights, cause trouble, and then end up as juvenile delinquents later in the criminal justice system and so forth. What might be going on? So they had this really huge study, and they followed infants through development until sort of their, I guess, early 30s. Now, what they did find was that there was indeed a subpopulation. who showed these character traits. But in addition, by the time that the years had rolled by, they were also in a position to do the genetic studies. And what they discovered was that a subset of this population had a mutation. And it was a mutation for an enzyme in the serotonin system, monoamine oxidase A. So the prediction was really quite high that if you carried that mutation that affects the serotonin system, affects the quantity of serotonin that's around, that you were going to show violent behavior. But there was an additional part of the result which was even more interesting. And one would just die to know the mechanism and circuitry part of the story, but it's this. If you carry the mutation and you're abused as a child, the probability of violent behavior goes way up. Very interesting result. And of course, part of what you'd like to know, by the way, it's carried on the Y chromosome, so that's why you see it more in males than in females, but almost certainly there are some females who have it on both X chromosomes, but it's likely to be a very small population. So how do we think about somebody like that, right? I mean, so I asked myself that, and I was at the Winter Brain meeting, and I was going to talk about this and say, should these people be held responsible? I mean, they're dreadful. So there is no question but that there's a public safety issue. But are they responsible for their behavior? So I was fairly late. And so I thought, well, I'll just watch Law and Order before I go to bed. And it was an MAOA mutant story. And so, yeah, sure enough, the guy was an MAOA mutant, and sure enough, he was abused as a child. So the story is that, he's killed somebody, and they're going to plea that he should be not guilty by reason of insanity, given that he's an MAOA mutant. I thought, fascinating. How are they going to handle this? Now, some of you may have heard this story before, but it is really, really dumb. They had him get into a fight in prison, and he got killed. Right? So we never knew what the judge would say or what the jury would say. And I thought afterwards, well, that's pretty disappointing. I really wanted to know what Law and Order would think about this. But it's a very tough case, and that's why they punted, of course, is, if you had a son or a brother in that condition, very tough. All right. So let me, in thinking about issues of control, just remind ourselves of the modulatory systems that play a really, really important role in reward. And reward is increasingly going to be part of the story. It can't just be that, I recognize that I have to give up that Twinkie because I have a strong will. It's that my reward system has been tuned up in such a way that I'm able to conjure up this image of the Twinkie and my rump getting fatter, and that causes inhibition of certain circuits, and I walk away, okay? That's got to be something like roughly what's going on. So we need to understand much more about reward circuitry, which is the dopamine system, but of course that's not the only thing that dopamine does, about the serotonin system, but the other non-specific systems that arise from brainstem nuclei. But it's important too to remember that these non-specific systems have these extraordinary properties. They're not carrying specific information in the way that glutamate mediated responses do. They modulate, they upregulate, they downregulate, but they're absolutely critical. And here, of course, you see the nuclei within the brainstem from which the serotonin projections arise, and then they project in this very, very broad way all over the brain. But notice in particular that these sorts of regions, right, medial, frontal, orbital, all these frontal regions are very heavily involved, are very heavily serviced, perhaps I should say, by the serotonin system. So in thinking along these lines, one of the sort of conceptual tools that I helped myself to is the idea that if we don't want to think about free will in the folk psychological way, and we want to begin to think about self-control in a more neurobiological, in terms of neurobiological mechanism, we might want to sort of conceive of it in terms of a parameter space. And what I've provided here is really quite crappy, but it conveys what I think is potentially a useful tool. And that is this, that I, of course, am only showing three parameters here. I'm showing, say, levels of serotonin, amygdala frontal connectivity, what is disrupted, for example, in the patients that the DiMaggio's have studied, dopamine levels. But there will be many, many other parameters as well, including parameters reflecting the hormones, reflecting factors like corticotropin-releasing factor, which regulates anxiety levels. But the basic idea, and since you can only see three here, it's possible to visualize what I mean, is that there is a kind of rough, boundaried volume within this space within which you can be in control, in the sense that you can make decisions that, by and large, serve your interest and the interests of your genes. And that if, for example, dopamine levels drop, you might sort of wander out of that space. But there are many different ways, then, of being in control, down here or down here, just as there are going to be a variety of ways of being out of control.
It seems like social factors, I mean, different societies might define that boundary a little bit differently.
I think that's right. That her point is that different societies might actually define this in a somewhat different way. And I think that that's a really important observation. And it's an observation that suggests that some of this work is going to be quite complicated. Guy Claxton makes the point that in Western societies, we often, and this might actually speak to your point too, we often identify ourselves in terms of our goals, our desires, and our preferences. Whereas, allegedly, and I'm really quite ignorant about this, but that other societies, especially Asian societies, tend to people identify themselves in terms of social role, in terms of the rituals that and their place in the rituals, and in terms of their relationships. And that suggests then that there's going to be, you know, flexibility and so forth there too. But I guess what sort of motivated me to think that there's probably a core here that's going to be common is this, that being in control, roughly speaking, is something that by and large is going to serve the animal well, right? You don't want to just run every time, you know, you think the big bad wolf is around. And you do want to have control over deferring gratification of various kinds. And so it probably is true that many animals have the capacity in varying degrees for, you know, overcoming pain in order to get the greater good. So Joe Ledoux, for example, is studying, and I think this is work that really, really interests me, studying the circuitry in the amygdala in rats. As you know, probably know, he's done immense amounts on the amygdala in rats that changes during fear conditioning. All right, so, but the next question is, what changes when the critter overcomes his fear? So you got them on the grid, and he goes on the grid, and he gets his little feet shocked, so he hates that. So he runs off, but if you put a goodie over here, he'll do it, right? He will overcome the pain. So you want to understand something about that. And obviously there's going to be lots of cases where it will serve the animal to redirect attention or to suppress a desire, or that a desire is suppressed, or that pain is suppressed in order to achieve something else. So there may be some cultural relativity, but I have a hunch, and I could be totally wrong about this, that there probably is a core to all of this. Now, before we move on to the simple question, where do moral principles come from, I'm wondering whether there are questions that you would like to raise at this point, either about how we think about decision-making and choice. Are there parts of the story that you'd like to add to this? Yes?
Just a couple of things. On the last slide, if those axes that constitute the space are purely internal, measurements about internal states of the particular individual, right? And you're trying to talk about control, it's very hard for me to make meaning out of that if you don't put in there control with respect to what? Right? I mean, control with respect to being pointed at with a gun, control with respect to falling over falling off a bridge, right? So it seems to me that if the context that surrounds the individual whose measurements you're taking is not taken into account, what does control mean? So that's just that question. And then the other one is that, and I think this might be related, is that there are other sort of philosophical and political traditions that don't really have a big problem with constrained behavior. And they give it names like hegemony or ideology or a bunch of different things to talk about social processes that purport to explain why we do or not do things, right? Constrained environments of action. And I wonder if those two things, I don't know how, could be made to talk to each other.
Yeah, no, those are both really very interesting questions. I mean, on the first question, it could turn out that this ends up not being a very useful way of talking about this at all. It's just that at the moment, because we see this interesting difference in behavior that serves one's own interest, between, say, someone with obsessive-compulsive disorder and someone without, then, you know, to a first pass, it looks like there should be a story there. But it might turn out that there isn't really. But there's another thing I think you're saying, which is really not included in this diagram, and I haven't quite found a way of including it, and that is that often being in control is very domain relative, so that a teenage boy might be highly self-disciplined with respect to the basketball court and his athletic gear and practice and so forth, but very impulsive in certain other domains having to do with, you know, being in a car and drinking with a bunch of guys or something of that kind. So there is that domain relativity as well. And so somebody like Mort Doran, the surgeon with Tourette's, in the domain of the operating theater, he really does not exhibit the tics, but otherwise he does. And I don't really know how to capture something like that. But I would like to see how far something like this can go. We also think, as you know, that in addiction there is compromise control, and that quite a lot is understood now about what addiction really looks like at the neuronal and molecular level. And so loss of control in addicts seems to me to be not only a kind of real and serious thing, but it's also something with absolutely extraordinary social impact. So we might be able to get a certain distance on this, but you know, I agree, it's hard to know. Yes?
So one thing I was going to point out is that I think your control space would probably shrink even more if you consider things like the Bruce McEwen's theories of allostasis and Amy Arnston's work on stress, where if you get to a critically high level of things like dopamine or norepinephrine, then protein synthesis in the frontal cortex actually shuts down. So instead you have an inverted U, and then that fits with George Koob's idea
that's
of
right, exactly. So
within addiction, and it all plays.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea. It really, really does. And so one would want to put in additional parameters exactly of that kind.
Yeah, and it helps with the domain specificity also, because one of the things that Arnstein says is that there's a switch, basically, in the amygdala between sort of a basal ganglia strategy and frontal cortex strategy based on how high things like norepinephrine and CRF are.
Hmm. Interesting. Where is that?
Arnston, Amy Arnston.
Okay, right. All right.
Mostly in monkey.
Mostly in monkey. Yeah. Good. Good. Okay. Anything else that anybody wants to raise on that? Yes.
The out of control region might also be qualified differently for different cases.
Yes.
Such as when you ask criminals why you've done this, they might give the reason of evil God inside me. So there is that short circuit between the higher beings that the society believes in for the purpose of our actions, and individual empties that space of individuality and leaves it between the society and the higher being that they believe. But when it comes to good deeds, they would say, well, anybody would do that. So that there is that compatibility between the society's values and the individual. And it seems like there are two different kind of out of control region in relation to the definition of the individual within that society.
I don't know. In fact, I have just been reading about what criminals do say about their behavior. And if you want to read about confabulation, that's really a great source. The Baustein is one of the people who's done really wonderful work on this. But you know, people who are the perpetrators, and this turns out to be true, even if what you're doing is taking a group of undergraduates and you say, I want you to remember something nasty that you did to somebody, and you know, it's, they were really upset and so forth, and just write about that. And basically, what they all say is some version of the following. Well, you know, it really wasn't as bad as they made it out to be. And they just blew it all out of proportion. They overreacted. And besides, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I couldn't really help myself, or, you know, I had had a drink or whatever. Then if you ask those same undergraduates to recount a story of what it was like when they were the victim of something nasty, they all say pretty much the same thing. Like, the person had absolutely no reason to do this. And it was really, really, really horrible. And so we have a point of view. I don't know whether we really want to call it confabulation or not. But when Baustein then went on to interview the really nasty serial killers and so forth, they would say many of the same things. Well, you know, the person sort of had it coming. And besides, you know, I didn't hurt them until, you know, I tried to kill them as easily as possible. I mean, they'd actually say those things. And besides, you know, well, it sort of happened before I realized what I was doing. We're very strange, we humans. Okay, so I'm going to try to finish up by saying a little bit about moral principles. And the reason I want to put that in here is because, in a way, the whole notion of responsibility and fairness of responsibility, fairness of punishment, and so forth, invites us to think in the broader context about what morality is and where it comes from and how it all makes sense. Okay, so there are basically three ideas about where moral principles come from. One is that they have a religious origin and they come from divine authority, and then there's different divines, of course. Other people think that they come out of reason and that humans uniquely have moral principles. And the third one, which is the most biological of the three and really appealed to David Hume, the Scottish philosopher of the 18th century, he felt that we have what he called a moral sentiment. We are disposed to cooperate and help and to be outraged by certain kinds of behavior. And I just want to say a little bit about each of those, and then, of course, I will take a biological approach. Socrates, and you know, I mean, this was a little over 2,000 years ago. Socrates actually had the right answer to people who think that morality comes from religion or comes from a divine source. And we have to kind of, every generation and every philosophy class, we need to remind people that what Socrates' argument was. And I'm sure those of you who've taken philosophy have been exposed to this. So there is Socrates. He's going to be put to death for persuading the youth of Athens to question authority. And a priest who really thinks quite well of himself is on the way to actually imprison his father. And he visits Socrates. And they begin to talk about what's right and what's wrong, what's moral and what's not. And so Socrates says, well, Euthyphro, you know, scratches his tummy, what makes something right? Euthyphro sort of says, well, you know, don't be such a pompous ass. I mean, of course, it's the gods. And so Socrates asks this question. He says, does God command something because it is right? Or is a command right because God commands it? So Euthyphro says, well, obviously not the second. Because if it were the second, then whatever the gods were to command, like take your firstborn, boil it up, throw it to the dogs, if the gods were to command such a thing, it would be right, according to the second. So, says Euthyphro, well, of course, obviously I didn't mean that. But then says Socrates, if it's the first, then notice that the rightness or wrongness inhering in our behavior comes not from the gods. The gods are, so to speak, at best, a mouthpiece, a communicator. So the result of this, I mean, there's many ways about talking about the relation between morality and religion, but the result of this very simple argument really is that any story you want to tell about the relation between religion and ethics suddenly becomes very complex. And now you have to do things that most of us find very awkward, like say that you have special knowledge that others can't have, that God wants thus and such to be done, or to be very dogmatic about which amongst the array of so-called sacred books is the right sacred book, and so forth. And it becomes difficult. And essentially, I think Aristotle, following after Plato, was Plato's pupil, realized that you have to give an answer that ultimately is rooted in the nature of what we are, our nature as biological beings. And that was a long time ago for Aristotle to actually realize that. And something that I think he would have understood completely is that we are social creatures. Those are our impulses. trustworthiness is a value. Building up a reputation as someone who helps, who can be counted on, means that in the long run, you do better than otherwise. So social isolation, we talked about this earlier, is a real cost. A lone wolf has a hard time of it. He has to scrounge for mice and gophers. A wolf within the pack can help bring down a caribou, and then there is a feast, and so forth. And I think it's very easy to imagine our ancestors in the ancestral condition, where banding together for mutual defense, food sharing, and so forth, was enormously valuable. So there's really two parts to the story of the biology of moral dispositions. And one is that we want models, we want to use the models of how the genetic platform can make social behaviors, altruism, cooperation, and so forth possible. And many people have been involved in making those models. William Hamilton, John Maynard Smith, Trivers, and many, many others. And the work is very beautiful. And one of the most recent issues of Science, I think a December issue, has several pieces in it, one by Novak and one by Bowles, that I think are especially important. And then there's the issue of the neurobiology of social behavior. When I first began studying neuroscience, the idea that we might actually understand some parts of social behavior in neurobiological terms just seemed far-fetched. No, not in my lifetime. But of course, it is happening. So we all know about the models about what you need in order for altruistic, in that special sense, traits to spread throughout a population. It's important that you need to be able to punish those who would violate the norms. And the models at least show that, and the models suggest that if you don't punish, then things very quickly over a few generations are such that the cheaters dominate the altruists. Now, but I really want, I wanted to get to a little bit about the neurobiology before we finish up here. Paul MacLean was a person, a neuroscientist, who in the 50s really launched the pioneering studies on the limbic system. Gave the limbic system the name, but he was very interested in the fundamental motivations and drives of behavior. And he realized very well that it was not going to come from fancy cortex, so to speak, but that it was the subcortical structures and the old part of cortex, the cingulate, gyrus, and related structures, that was going to be the essential part of the story. And he made this observation, which I thought was very prescient, and I think is probably right. He said, well, here, notice what is new with mammals. He was a great observer of animals as well. Nursing and parental care, you basically don't see it in crocodiles. Playful behavior, learning social skills, learning the social norms, separation vocalization, right? So the infant is alone, and it whimpers and cries and or what have you, and then mate attachment. Those four things. And he said then, the history of the evolution of mammals is the history of the development of a family way of life. And I think that that's an interesting idea. And it's become more interesting in the last decade because of the understanding of the role of peptides in social attachment. And so here we have the nursing mother. The infant gets oxytocin release in this condition, and that helps form permanent attachment. The mother gets oxytocin release in her brain. And actually, the infant also gets oxytocin through the milk. And here, of course, we have baboons with a baboon infant. And notice how, I mean, this is not something you see, again, in crocodiles or in turtles. But it is the sort of thing that is common in primates. Now, I want to quickly get to my favorite story, which is the story of the voles. Now, this is a story that came about actually, first of all, because somebody noticed what you might call the most primitive social behavior in, of all things, C. elegans. In C. elegans, the nematode, right? The teeny weeny nematode. It's only got 1,000+ neurons. So in conditions of food scarcity, there's two kinds of nematodes. There's the nematodes that, you know, go off on their own, and there's the nematodes that hang together. And it turned out that a simpler form of oxytocin is what's involved. And then people noticed that there are two kinds of voles. There's prairie voles and there's montane voles. They're not interbreedable, but they're very similar in their appearance. And so there's a couple of prairie voles and there's a montane vole. And one significant behavioral difference is that the prairie voles are monogamous pair bonders. After the first mating, there is a rush of oxytocin in the female brain, a rush of vasopressin in the male brain. They are bonded for life. They are also biparental, both take care of the pups. They are very aggressive towards others that intrude into the nest. The montane voles are promiscuous pair bonders. Now, they have oxytocin and vasopressin, so what's the difference? The difference is in the brain and in very particular areas in the brain, ventral pallidum and lateral septum, where there is high density of receptors for vasopressin in males and oxytocin in females. So they did all the manipulations you could think of, right? Change the receptor density in these guys, they become monogamous. Take out the receptors in these guys, they become promiscuous, and so on and so forth. So it turns out that this very simple peptide, and vasopressin and oxytocin differ in only two places. This very simple peptide mediates something, monogamous pair bonding, that I at least was raised to believe was a great cultural achievement of Christianity. I mean, what can you say? And here it is. I mean, I'm a monogamous pair bonder, and I always thought that, you know, I kind of reasoned through this and thought, yes, this is good, this is the way I should be. No, it's probably all the oxytocin and the oxytocin receptors sitting up there in my lateral septum and my ventral pallidum. And I thought I'd made a decision, no, not in any sense that would satisfy the framework of folk psychology. Isn't that amazing? I mean, this is a big life decision, right, to be a monogamous pair bonder. Well, it's a big life style, but it's not exactly a decision. Very interesting.
How did Paul react?
Yes, well, okay. Can always count on Gary. I won't go into the details of the brain story. Suffice it to say, go online if you want more articles. Sue Carter, Larry Young. And of course, they are looking now at humans. Sue is particularly interested because they discovered that rat pups who don't get cuddled and so forth by their rat mums do not flourish as well, and they have social behavior problems later on. And it has also been observed that human infants who also don't get cuddled and have, you know, regular parental attachment and so forth have both higher CRF levels. There's also a change in the glutamate receptors, but I forgot exactly whether it's up or down. But they too have sometimes, for example, difficulties forming long-term relationships and various kinds of social difficulties. So that's an interesting part of the story. The other interesting part of the story was done by Paul Zak and others, and there's somebody else who's done this too, but I forgot who it is. So what would happen if you just, you know, raised my oxytocin level under some conditions? So they thought, well, what we'll do is we'll have these guys play a game. Let's just call it Prisoner's Dilemma to keep it simple. And these guys will play a game. And we're going to give these guys oxytocin. And the way we're going to do it is very simple. You're going to put it in an aerosol and just squirt it up their nose and count on the olfactory bulb to get it where it needs to be, which it pretty much does. So then the question is, what do you see? And the answer is, these guys are much more trusting, cooperative, engaging, and these guys behave like normals. Very interesting. Is it that they're generally just sort of gotten warm and fuzzy? I mean, and so you have them play the Prisoner's Dilemma game with a computer, you don't see it. So it's human interactions that change. I think this is really big stuff. I don't know where it's all going, and I don't know what it all means. But I think it's immensely interesting. This is the last slide, then. So I just feel that, given all of these developments, that it's exciting to kind of think about values and to think about morality in a different way. That evolution has sort of set the kind of parameters for the brain style of our drives and emotions and our basic nature. But of course, part of our basic nature is that we are great imitators, as Tomasello was fond of pointing out, but also that we have great plasticity. So we can learn many different kinds of social conventions, some of which really penetrate quite deeply into our sense of ourselves. But these are, I think, things that we can understand in a biological way without really needing to rely on metaphysics in any sort of grand sense at all. Thanks. Yeah.
And also the last thing on oxytocin and about the custom. These are chemical axes that you're using to represent this behavior, but there's a lot more just to chemistry to control the pair. For example,
yes.
There's neuronal activity and oscillation.
Absolutely.
And for something like Tourette's or Parkinson's, let's say, which someone has a tremor that they're completely out of their control, you could just put a deep brain stimulator and you could make that pattern completely go away. Just
yeah.
The memory potential.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's a lot more to this thing of being
controlled. Yes.
At different scales. So there's different scales. There's a molecular scale, there's also like neural circuits and all that. And
yes, indeed.
There's something that comes to mind, which is this concept of the fixed action patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Rolf Lienz and Mark Allies that have been championing this, which is that you can't control every single detail of a behavior. Let's say like grabbing a cup of water because there's too many degrees of freedom and you can't control that consciously. So throughout evolution, we've developed these things that are helpful to unconsciously control all those little details,
but
just consciously activate the actual process of moving. So in that framework, you could think of Tourette's syndrome as just throwing in unconsciously a fixed action pattern to, say, a ward, or in Parkinson's, not having control over the tremor, or in depression, let's say, you can't stop ruminating, obsessive compulsive the same. And maybe even the issue of confabulation, there's the possibility that the brain is just automatically likes to generate hypothesis about the possible causal structure of the world. But it's missing some information because it's only the left hemisphere making the decision. So it'll just like make a fixed action pattern to make a model.
There is a lot of things in what you say and a lot of really interesting things. And the first thing that you said is that if we're going to think about a control parameter space, it is an open question whether you want to think about it at the molecular level as part of mind does, or whether you want to think about it at the microcircuit or the macrocircuit and so forth. And I think that we just wait and see how that works out. And so there, it may be that, and when Bill Bechtel comes to talk about mechanism and how to think about mechanisms and the relation between levels of organization in the brain and levels at which a mechanism resides, I think we'll just have to see how the data really come out on that. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just wondering, when you talked initially about sort of the folk psychology, you know, idea of free will, and you said and that's was not the approach that the kind of cognitive scientists take, that we take a more materialistic approach to some extent. You know,
to some extent,
the brain
yeah.
is, you know, the person's brain. And so I'm wondering to what extent that you think that view is compatible with this notion that if someone can not be in total control of their internal state, that we should excuse them from responsibility in certain cases in which you're essentially saying, okay, well, if they were not fully conscious or they were not fully willing their own action, then we should divorce this internal person who's responsible for the action from the, you see what I'm saying?
You mean my left hemisphere made me do it sort of thing?
I guess that would be one way of putting it. Like, to what extent is that compatible with this saying that the brain is the person, but then we can still distinguish them in cases of moral responsibility?
Yeah, well, I think this is why this is a deep question, a deep issue. But ultimately, you want to think about punishment, not in terms of, is it fair? I mean, I don't want to sound like a moral cretin, but I mean, the fundamental thing about punishment is, does it serve the social purpose it's meant to, right? Does it deter? Does it keep people from taking the law into their own hands? Does it involve public safety? Now, that is quite a different way, I think, of thinking about why we punish, at least in some ways. But ultimately, I mean, lots of people agree that's why we punish, but then they want to say, and it's got to be fair. And I think, well, I think what ideas about fairness really reflect is whether the punishment will do what it's supposed to do. Now, there's no point in punishing someone who's a sleepwalker. because they didn't, you know, it's not part of their character, they're not going to do it again. And as long as you, somebody else should talk about this while I get. I think that our concepts of fairness, and I think that's what you really see in Aristotle, when he says the default is that you hold people responsible unless they were involuntarily intoxicated or unless they were sleepwalking. And then, of course, we come to the issue of unless they were insane, by which he said he meant they didn't know who they were. And then, of course, we've tried to revise that. But ultimately, I think those ways of carving it up and allowing certain things as excuses have to do with our convictions about what we can predict about the person's behavior. So if, for example, I'm on a train with someone, he has an epileptic seizure and he hits me across the face, are we going to punish him? No, because in that instance, we know how to stop that behavior. And it isn't an expression of his character. On the other hand, you know, if it's someone like Jeff Skilling, right, who's a conner and a manipulator and so forth, then it looks like you can predict what he'll do if you don't put him in jail. You can do the same thing. And also, you want to deter people who might think about doing a Jeff Skilling kind of thing. Whereas if you punish an epileptic in the condition mentioned, is that going to deter anybody from hitting me? Probably not. So it sounds kind of crass to say it, that ultimately that's the way, you know, excuses and so forth are made. But I think in actual fact, that's the way they should be made. And so this really raises tremendously important social questions about the drug laws and whether the drug laws could be improved upon. Does that, but I mean, the issues you're raising are huge. And in fact, there's going to be a meeting. This is quite an interesting thing. There's going to be a meeting at UC Riverside of judges in California and a group of neuroscientists. So, because they want to learn about the brain and they want to know about, you know, what is frontality exactly and what is the serotonin system exactly and so forth. And I will be going also, but I'm sort of hoping to learn more. I mean, I want to know how they see some of these things with the emerging science.
Yeah, so just one last comment on that. It's interesting because it's almost in the case of someone who, say, is legally insane, it seems almost like we're drawing a distinction between the actions of, like, punishment as being for the individual as the decider and the individual as a system in terms of public safety.
I think
it's just that.
Yeah. But I mean, there is no doubt that these issues are very difficult. So when Andrea Yates drowned her five children in the bathtub, there was no question but that she was psychotic. And nobody in Texas disputed that. But of course, Texas at this time has only one criterion for insanity, and that's the cognitive criterion. Do you know the difference between right and wrong? Now, hitherto, many states also had the volitional criterion that said, yes, you know the difference between right and wrong, but are you capable of acting on that? Now, many states changed the law after Hinckley shot Reagan, because Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity under the volitional component. The argument was that he did know that it was wrong to try to assassinate the president, but he was so overwhelmingly obsessed with Jodie Foster and so overwhelmingly convinced that only the assassination of Reagan would endear her to him, what can you say? And of course they presented the whole case as it had developed over years, that he was volitionally incapable of doing anything else. And the jury bought it. And so after that, many states said, so no volitional component. So in Texas, when Andrea Yates drowned the five children, they might have found her not guilty but under the volitional component had it existed. But her actions were very deliberate. She knew what she was doing. She knew it was against the law. She called the police. But of course, she thought that her children were all possessed by Satan and this was their best hope. So how did people, reasonable people, you know, your friends that you talked to about this? I mean, I think people were just very conflicted. I knew many very sensible, well-meaning people who said, you know, they had a hanger. I mean, and other people who said, you know, she should be in the home for the criminally insane. And I don't think there's a right answer. I mean, you desperately do not want people like that to do those things. And of course, institutions for the criminally insane are marginally different. I mean, like, hardly different at all from prisons. But you have to have some means of protection. I mean, the social safety issue is clearly extremely important. For example, with the MAOA mutants. So I think I think they're really, really, really hard issues. I mean, the great thing I love about science is that it doesn't have anything to do with solving political problems, right? You know, you read the New York Times in the morning and then thank God you can go back to reading Nature. So I think it's just really tough. Really tough. You want that? Ah, right, yes. Yeah, I can't see a thing over there, so. Yeah, John.
You know, you've indicated that these are obviously far more complex than we can fully apprehend at the moment. Yet the examples you've given, like a sleepwalker or an epileptic seizure, are far too simple, because the agenda that you set forth is basically saying that we will, in the not too distant future, be able to say of the child molester, aha, there is something truly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We understand how and why it occurs in the brain.
Yeah.
And we could very imaginably get to the point where we could treat that with tremendous efficacy.
Yeah.
But that's not going to change the fact from a social justice perspective that that person has done a series of actions
yeah.
that are so reprehensible from the point of resemblance to some volitional act
mm-hmm.
that they must be in a system for
right.
retribution. So even if we could exculpate them totally because of new models of neuroscience of free will,
right.
I don't think we could ever take away the retributive part of justice, which presents this enormous breakdown here.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, we're saying, aha, they're
yep.
not really responsible. They may do things totally from some kind of problem and then confabulate why they did them, you know, showing how much their free will is just a product of these neural machinations. But ultimately, you know, they did do this to a handful
yeah.
of children.
Yeah,
and the
yeah.
parents and the society and
oh,
everyone
yeah.
else is just furious.
Yeah.
So even if you could predict they'd never do it again because they've been treated in some way, you'd have to lock them up for some serious effect.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to raise that, because And I kind of touched on this earlier, because I kind of share with you the idea, really, that that the need for retribution is an important part of, and the need to have it satisfied, rather, is an important part of social stability. And I don't know that you can, I mean, there's obviously a big variation in humans, and in the capacity to forgive. The woman whose husband had the brain tumor and who molested her daughter, they did get back together and she did put it behind her, but at least to the best of my knowledge. But I agree, if it had been something really horrendous, like killing a child, then it even if you could treat the person so that it didn't happen again, there would be a residual question. And I don't know, I mean, I've thought about this a lot. I don't know whether that's a moral question or whether it's just a factual question about what people socially will tolerate. I really just don't know. Was there someone else over there who had a question?
Yeah, here.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm right in the black hole.
Yes, you are. Okay.
So, as for your overall account, do you really think you've made that much progress as compared to initial approaches like in Greek philosophy? The reason why I'm asking is because it seems that you still have two factors in your account. One is evolution, the other one is, and sort of social constructs, the other one is the genetic consequences, probably, of evolution in some sense. So you still don't know what actually influences self-control or free will. It's still a sort of chicken and egg problem. Could you maybe elaborate a little on that and tell me whether that's accurately the way I understood that? Because, you sort of started out with Socrates and you had this sort of twofold option of what causes free will. And you seem to have arrived at a similar twofold account in some sense. Is it evolution that causes it, or the genetic modifications that probably arise in the process of?
Well, the story of evolution came up mainly in the context of talking about the nature of social attachment and social behavior and behavior that we call moral behavior. And the self-control story, I think, is a story that we will probably slowly unravel as we understand more about the role of emotions and drives and other kinds of motivations and how the reward system is changed as a result of learning, and thus how animals are able to learn about the social norms and about what counts as sharing, what counts as reciprocity, and so forth. I'm not sure whether I've answered your question adequately or not. I mean, part of your question was, well, how much progress is there really on all this? And I think that's a really good question.
I found it, yeah, I found it very interesting. But it seems to me that as for, yeah, what you arrive in the end still has the same problems as very early accounts, in some sense, of not being able to find the sort of ultimate source.
I guess, well, I don't think that it's a thing that sort of springs into being when I need to make a decision, that's for sure. I mean, I think there is this ongoing movement. I mean, this is Rodolfo, somebody brought up Rodolfo Linus. There's this ongoing movement. I mean, we're always moving. What initiates the eye movement? You know, here, 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 as I'm scanning around the class. Well, that may not be the best way to tackle that question, because there's always movement. And then when I get hungry, I find myself, you know, steaming away towards the refrigerator and so forth. So I guess I would just kind of take it, look at it in a slightly different way. But before you all go, well, first of all, normally we would have a third hour for those who are registered in the class so we could continue the discussion if we wished. Today we have a job candidate in the philosophy department, and so I'm sort of obliged to go to the talk, and that starts at 4, so I need to do that. The other thing is that I think there are about 40 graduate students who are actually registered for the course. I need to figure out what your work will be so that I've got something to grade such that I can give you a grade at the end, but I'll give some thought to that. But probably a very short sort of two-page paper is the kind of thing that we'll think about. But if you can think about something that you think might work, I'd be happy to hear about that as well. And so next week, we will have John Reynolds, and he will talk about attention. I will ask John for several papers, and we'll put them on the course website so that you can download those papers. Okay, anything that I've missed or that we need to talk about? Okay, so just be the 2 hours for today.